Not. Because I'm going somewhere else instead. Amy made for the stairs. I'm off to bed now, ma'am. But where's the somewhere else you're going? Moira hissed from the bottom of the stairs, not wanting to wake Jackie and Biddy, who had gone to bed ages ago and would be fast asleep by now. New Brighton. There'll be someone coming for me in a car at about 10 o'clock. In a car? And who will that? But before she could finish the question, the front bedroom door closed with a snap. Why hadn't Kathy come in for a cup of cocoa? Moira wondered. Perhaps the girls had had a row, and that was the reason for Amy's funny look. But it hadn't been a miserable funny look. She'd go round to Kathy's there and then and ask her outright. Except her mother, Elsie Burns, frightened the living daylights out of her. Kathy apart, the Burnses were a violent family. Two of their lads had been in prison, and their mother was the most violent of them all. She looked in the cigarette packet. There was one left. Good. In a minute, she'd make a cup of cocoa, smoke the ciggy, then go to bed. Though she supposed she'd best ask Charlie and Marion if they'd like a drink. She could hear them talking when she knocked on the parlour door and opened it just a crack in case they were up to something. Would you like a cup of cocoa in there? She had no idea why she whispered. No, Tar, ma'am, Charlie said in a normal voice. Marion is going home in a minute. Good night, Marion. Good night, Mrs. Curran. Moira winced. Marion's tone was so unfriendly. Or was it just that she was shy? Whatever, she was a strange girl who lived in a Catholic hostel in Everton Valley. Prizing information from her about her background was harder than removing teeth. According to Charlie, she was born in Dundalk, on the east coast of Ireland, a place she had left for Liverpool when she was barely 14. Now she was 20, and in the meantime, she had managed to lose most of her Irish accent, as well as learn to type and do shorthand. They're dead, she'd snapped when Moira asked about her mam and dad. Moira hadn't liked to ask if she had any brothers or sisters and have her head bitten off a second time. Furthermore, Moira was getting quite hot under the collar, she would have liked to impress upon Marion what a catch she was getting in Charlie Curran. There wasn't a young woman in the whole of Bootle who wouldn't have accepted him like a shot had he proposed. He was an apprentice draughtsman at the English Electric, actually had his own drawing board, and was the only man in the street who went to work in a suit. Even more impressive, Charlie was buying his own house. It was in Aintree, by the racecourse, and had just finished being built, along with 100 or so others. He and Marion went every Sunday to see how it was progressing. Moira had hardly met a person in her whole life who owned a house. Oh, what the hell! Moira made the cocoa, sank into her armchair, lit the ciggy, and picked up her book. She'd think about it tomorrow, or the next day. Right now, she didn't really care. She'd forgotten to tell Charlie that Amy wasn't going to the sports day tomorrow, but she didn't care about that either. Kathy went in to find their Lily sitting on the stairs, apparently waiting for her to come home. You bitch! Lily shrieked, launching herself at her sister. I was wondering where me red coat had gone. Kathy had forgotten she was wearing her sister's coat. I'm sorry, sis, she began, but Lily wasn't prepared to listen to any explanation Kathy was able to think up on the spur of the moment. She grabbed a handful of hair and tugged hard. Kathy screamed, and Mrs. Burns came into the hall and banged the girls' heads together. They both screamed. Mrs. Burns screamed, Grow up the pair of yous! She slapped Kathy's face. That's for pinching your sister's coat! Lily smirked, but not for long. And that's for pulling your sister's hair! Mrs. Burns snarled as she slapped her other daughter's face. The front door opened, and Mr. Burns came in, witnessed the goings-on in the hall, and immediately went out again before his wife could have a go at him. He went round the back to sit in the lavatory in the yard until he felt sober and things had calmed down a bit. Jesus! Lily ran upstairs. I hate living in this bloody house! Kathy followed more slowly, nursing her head in one hand and her left cheek in the other. If only Amy had asked her in for a cup of cocoa. Lily would have been in bed by the time Kathy came home and hung the red coat at the back of the wardrobe. As far as I know, it's been there all the time, she would have said tomorrow had Lily asked. Kathy saw little of Amy over the next few weeks. It felt odd without her. For years they'd done everything together. Cathy had always realised the day would come when they'd both meet someone they'd want to marry, but had imagined it happening to them at about the same time. That they'd go out in a foursome, get married, have babies, their friendship continuing unbroken as the years went by. She was pleased when, one Sunday, Amy called and suggested they go to Mass, then spend the rest of the day together. It was the way their Sundays had always been spent in the past. "We can walk along the docky into town and have a cuppa in Lyons," Amy said. It was May. The weather was getting warmer and the days longer. The relationship with Barney must be cooling off, Cathy thought. But it turned out that it was Barney's dad's birthday and friends were coming for the day. "Why weren't you invited?" Cathy inquired. "Barney doesn't want me to meet his mam just yet. She'd throw a fit if she found out he was going to marry a Catholic." "You're getting married?" Cathy could scarcely believe her ears. It was 3 weeks ago, to the very day, that she and Amy had gone to Southport, and the last thought in either of their heads was of getting serious with a chap. Now here was Amy, acting very distant, and talking about marriage. "Well, we're thinking about it, but don't say anything to me, ma'am." Amy refused to meet her eyes. "Are you coming to church or not?" she asked. "I won't be a mo. I'll just fetch me hat." They walked to St. James's mainly in silence. Cathy had a thought that made her go all funny. She'd like to bet that Amy and Barney had slept together. There was just something about her friend, not just that she looked older, but she acted older. On that day in Southport, she'd stopped being a girl and become a woman. After Mass, they walked along the docky into town, had a lemonade each in Lyons, then managed to scrape enough together for the front seats in the Scala, where they saw Captain Blood with Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland. It was years old, and they'd seen it before, but it was better than trying to talk to each other. Amy appeared to be lost in thought most of the time, and kept smiling secret little smiles. She responded when Cathy spoke to her, but it was as if she was being awakened from a delightful reverie. Cathy felt she was intruding, so gave up. She was glad that the tram home was so crowded they couldn't sit next to each other. That night she badly wanted to cry herself to sleep, but crying wasn't a practical proposition when she slept in the same bed as Lily, who was likely to give her a thump if woken. But she would never have another friend like Amy, and it would seem she'd lost her forever. When she came home from work a few days later, Cathy found an anxious Mrs. Curran hovering on the corner of Amethyst Street, apparently waiting for her. Cathy really liked Amy's mam. She was slim and pretty and always dressed nicely, even though all her clothes were second-hand. Today she wore a smart mauve dress with short sleeves and a pleated bodice. She asked Cathy if she wouldn't mind coming round to Agate Street after she'd had her tea. "I'd like a word with you, love. It's about our Amy." "Will she be there?" "No, love. She's going to see a show at the Prince's Theatre in Birkenhead. She won't be home till all hours." Cathy was glad of something to do. Two of her sisters were married, and the other two, Lily and Frances, were courting. They had no time for her. She'd been stuck for places to go and people to go with since Amy had met Barney Patterson. After she'd eaten, she went round to the Currans. Mrs. Curran made a pot of tea, set everything nicely on a tray, including a plate of broken biscuits that included some Bourbon creams, Cathy's favourite. "Help yourself, love," she said, when they were seated in the parlour and she had lit a ciggy. Cathy's evening meal had consisted of a piece of dry bread, as thick as a brick, soaked in watery mincemeat. She was still hungry, and gratefully helped herself to the biscuits. Her mam didn't believe in puddings. "It's about our Amy's birthday," Mrs. Curran began. "As you know, she'll be 18 on the 1st of June. I was wondering what to do about a party." "Have you talked it over with Amy?" "Not yet, no. It's awful hard to pin her down these days."
"She might not want a party."
Cathy couldn't visualise tall, handsome Barney Patterson in the Curran's little house when he was used to a much bigger one in Calderstones. Mrs. Curran put her cup back in the saucer with a clatter.
"Oh, Cathy, love," she cried. "I asked you here to talk about more than parties. It's this chap our Amy's knocking about with. What's he like? She refuses to bring him home. He used to pick her up and drop her off outside the house, but when I threatened to go out and introduce myself, he stopped coming. Amy must have told him to wait somewhere else. She won't even tell me what his name is or what he does for a living. I mean, is he a Catholic? What sort of family does he come from? Where does he live?
She began to cry just as Jackie and Biddy came storming downstairs and shouted they were going out.
Out where?
Mrs. Curran shouted back. The girls came into the room. They had Amy's hair, Amy's blue eyes, even Amy's features. Yet there was something indefinable that prevented them from being as radiantly pretty as their elder sister.
Hello, Kathy, they chorused cheerfully. We're going to Stanley Park with Phyllis McNamara, ma'am. And what are you going to do there?
Their mother demanded.
The girls looked at each other, puzzled. Just talk, ma'am,
Jackie said after a while.
That's right, ma'am. We're just going to talk,
Biddy confirmed.
All right, then, but don't be home late. Why do they need to go all the way to Stanley Park just to talk?
Mrs. Curran asked when the front door slammed. Kathy said she didn't know, but that it was what she and Amy had always done, at which Mrs. Curran sniffed tearfully.
I wish me and our Amy talked a bit more. She's become dead secretive. Jackie and Biddy have noticed, and they're awful upset. Charlie's annoyed because she was rude to Marion the other day. It all dates back to that Sunday when you both went to Southport. I take it she met this chap there. She was in a really funny mood when she came home.
She looked sorrowfully at Kathy, her eyes full of tears.
His name's Barney Patterson,
Kathy said slowly. She tried to remember all the questions Mrs. Curran had asked.
He lives in Calderstones and he has a brother called Harry. His father has a factory in Skelmersdale that makes medical instruments. They're not Catholics, she added.
His mam would throw a fit if she found out Barney was marrying a Catholic, Amy had said. And Harry had looked a bit dismayed in Southport when she mentioned having been to Mass.
Barney isn't working at the moment. He finished university last year and he's going to join the forces. University,
Mrs. Curran said faintly. She'd gone quite pale.
Our Amy is going out with a chap who's got a car and been to university. Where did they meet?
On Southport Pier.
She wished she could have told Mrs. Curran the way they'd so obviously felt about each other, but that wasn't really any of her business. Any road, she wasn't sure if she would be able to describe it. And it would be like telling tales if she said that Amy had actually mentioned marriage.
Will she be all right, do you think? I mean, what sort of chap is he?
I don't really know, Kathy confessed. He seemed all right. His brother Harry is really nice. I hardly spoke to Barney.
He'd been too wrapped up in Amy.
What's going to come of it, Kathy?
Mrs. Curran asked in a shaky voice.
Let's hope it doesn't last, eh?
She looked at Kathy for confirmation, but Kathy just smiled vaguely and said,
We'll just have to see.
Kathy called in at the Currans every few days, more for Mrs. Curran's sake than her own. She was too sensible and proud to allow herself to be miserable for long because her friend had dropped her. There were loads of girls at Woolworths she could go with to the pictures or to a dance at the Rialto or the Floral Hall in Southport. She was fast making new friends, but promised Mrs. Curran that she would come round on Amy's 18th birthday and bought a present, a box of embroidered hankies, in readiness.
She's bringing Barney round at last, Mrs. Curran said breathlessly on her most recent visit. It won't exactly be a party. Our Charlie and Marion will be there, Jackie and Biddy, and of course you, love. I'll just make a few sarnies and a bun loaf and get a bottle of sherry in.
Kathy promised to come round at 6:30. It turned out to be a day she would never forget. The 1st of June was horrible. The sky was a thick blanket of dark grey clouds, and although it didn't rain, the air was full of moisture that stuck to the face like wet cobwebs. Just before 6:30, when Kathy was on her way to Agate Street, the sun came out, just in time for Amy's party. Lucky old Amy, she thought. Everything seems to go right for her, even the weather. When she turned the corner, she saw that Barney's car was already outside the Curran's house. Kathy knocked, and Biddy opened the door. She rolled her eyes and said in a voice that quivered with excitement, "Now our Amy's really gone and done it." "What's happened?" Cathy asked, alarmed.
"She and that fella of hers only got married today, didn't they?"
Biddy said with an enormous grin.
"Mom's doing a nut, and our Charlie's awful annoyed. Me, I'm dead envious. I wish someone with a car would ask me to marry them."
"There's plenty of time, Biddy," Cathy assured her. She was only 14. She went inside and found the entire family, apart from Marion, in the parlour. Barney was standing in front of the fireplace, looking very much at home, while Amy and Charlie tried to comfort Mrs. Curran, who was having a mild case of hysterics.
"How could you do this to me?" she wept. "How could you? Me own daughter getting married without inviting a man."
"It was a private wedding," Amy said, half to Cathy and half to her mother. "No one else was there. We asked two guests from another wedding to be witnesses. Then we went to a photographer's shop and had our photos taken."
"You must have known how much it would hurt your mum," Cathy said coldly.
"You don't know the circumstances, Cathy," Amy said just as coldly. For the first time, Cathy noticed her friend was wearing a lovely white silk frock that reminded her slightly of the one she'd hankered after in the window of the shop in Southport. It didn't have a tail, but looked just as expensive. Her hair was piled in a knot on top of her head, from which little curls had escaped to perch on her forehead, around her ears, and on her white, slender neck. Her hat comprised two white silk roses and a little scrap of white net. Cathy had never seen her look so beautiful. And Barney hadn't been at the back of the queue when the Lord handed out good looks. He was as handsome as a film star in his dark suit and dazzling white shirt, a lock of brown hair hanging tantalizingly over one eye. He was smiling a really seductive smile and couldn't take his eyes off his new wife.
"Will anyone ever look at me like that?" Cathy wondered with a pang.
Charlie patted his mother on the back and Amy gave her a little shake.
"Don't take on so, ma'am. Me and Barney never dreamt you'd be so upset."
"I just wanted to be at me own daughter's wedding," Mrs. Curran said pitifully. "But not in one of them awful register office places, love. It should have been in a Catholic church, so you'd be married in the eyes of God."
"Oh, ma'am, things like that don't matter."
"They matter to me, love," her mother cried. "Does Barney's ma'am know you and him are married?"
"Not yet, Mrs. Curran," Barney replied. Cathy wasn't sure what happened next. Looking back, she vaguely remembered that, like a magician, Barney had produced a bottle of champagne, a box of elegant fluted glasses, and a gold locket and chain for Mrs. Curran. He then began kissing everyone in sight, including Cathy. He gave Jackie and Biddy a pound note each, thereby becoming their friend for life, and shook hands with Charlie. A warm extended shake that also involved squeezing Charlie's shoulder with his other hand. Amy's mother was still crying while she examined the locket that Amy promised would one day have her and Barney's photos inside. But the tears were more happy than sad. He'd charmed everybody. Or so Cathy thought. She'd forgotten all about Marion. When she went into the living room, she was sitting at the table, staring into space.
"Would you like some champagne?" Cathy asked. "There's still some left."
"No, thank you." Marion was a sallow-skinned young woman with jet-black hair, an unnaturally thin nose and thick eyebrows that made her face appear rather mannish. Barely 20, she looked a good 25. She was also a bit of a snob and insisted on calling Charlie Charles. They were getting married in September, but no one could understand what he saw in her.
"I don't know how Amy could do something like that to her mother," she said bitterly. "Charles told me how hard she worked for years and years to make sure her kids didn't go without, and look what she gets in return from her daughter. Me, I was put to work in the family business from the age of 5, but diamond cut diamond, that's what my own mother always used to say."
Cathy had never heard the expression before. It turned out that it meant tit for tat. Chapter 3. April 1971. Pearl. Miss Burns lit another cigarette. Her office smelt like a pub. The ashtray on her desk was already full of stubs, and it was only lunchtime.
Diamond cut diamond. Have you heard of that saying, Pearl?
Marion comes out with it all the time. It means getting your own back, retribution, something like that.
Tit for tat.
It's what she said the day your mum and dad got married. She was the only person that your dad didn't charm the socks off. Pretty soon he had everyone eating out of his hand, even me. I had thought I didn't like him, which was most unfair. I hardly knew him until then. Can you remember much about him, your dad?
Not a great deal, I confessed. He'd been a distant figure, and I'd felt in awe of him, frightened even. He'd scared me the way he'd used to shout at my mother, calling her names. Sometimes he would tell me a story, making it up as he went along, neither of us knowing how it would end.
Since my mother had come out of prison a week ago, and, according to the newspapers, gone to ground, Miss Burns had asked me into her office every day to discuss where she might be and who she was with. She spent half the lunch hour staring into space and reminiscing about her old friend. I telephoned Harry the other day, in case he might know where she was, but he said he hadn't a clue, she was saying now. It's surprising in view of what happened that he doesn't bear Amy a grudge, and neither does his father. Mrs. Patterson, on the other hand, loathed Amy. After the trial, she made a huge fuss, claiming she should have been hanged. She actually petitioned the Home Secretary about it. She stubbed out her cigarette and lit another. I wondered if there was a time in the day when she didn't have a cigarette in her mouth, or was about to light another. She blew smoke in the air and looked at it with disgust. You'll never believe this, Pearl, but when I was young, I swore I'd never take up smoking. The trouble is, everyone in the forces did it during the war. I looked for a way of changing the subject from the past to the present. Perhaps the person who picked my mother up was someone she'd met in prison, I suggested. I suppose it could have been that model she got friendly with, Nellie something or other. I didn't answer. I'd never heard of Nellie something or other. Perhaps my silence got through to Miss Burns and she realised how sick I was of the whole subject. Or perhaps she thought I was just hungry. She said, I'm taking up all your lunch hour, aren't I, dear? Perhaps we could go for a meal one night. My treat, naturally, and we could talk there. That would be nice. At least it would be better than her regularly phoning the staff room to request that I come to her office. Hilda Dooley was becoming suspicious. Maybe she was worried that I, the youngest teacher in the school and the last to arrive, was about to be promoted. That night Charles wondered aloud where my mother might be. Marion was annoyed.
Trust Amy to make a drama out of it, she complained. I can understand her wanting to go into hiding, but not from us.
Well, you, she conceded when Charles gave her a funny look. Reporters had waited outside Holloway the day Amy Patterson had been released, and they were still interested in her disappearance. There'd been photos in the paper of her speeding away from prison in a white Rolls Royce that had turned out to be hired. Charles jumped every time the telephone rang or someone knocked on the door, in case one of the newspapers had tracked him down. Aintree was miles away from Bootle, but it was still part of Liverpool.
It's you they'll want to talk to more than anyone, Pearl, he said. Amy's daughter. You'd be a real find.
The uncertainty was getting me down. On Saturday, I did what I always did when I was feeling low. Went into town and bought some clothes. I convinced myself I badly needed something that was both summery and sensible for school. As I wandered around the ladies' clothes departments in Lewis's and Owen Owen's, wishing I hadn't already bought an outfit for Trish's wedding so I could get one now, I tried to push anything that wasn't connected with clothes to the back of my mind. It proved quite easy after a while. After trying on an assortment of frocks, blouses and skirts, I eventually chose a calf-length grey voile dress with a white collar in Owen Owen's. It had hardly been in my possession for a minute when I decided it was too dressy for school. So I bought a dark blue linen skirt and a white broderie anglais blouse as well. I took everything up to the restaurant on the top floor and ordered a coffee. Tonight I was going to dinner with Charles and Marion, and I would wear the dress then. I mentally went through my shoes. The dress would go perfectly with my white wedge-heeled sandals. The waitress arrived with the coffee. As I stared into the brown depths, my mood changed. Charles and Marion were only going to dinner for my sake. It was Saturday, Trish had gone down to London to look at property for her and Ian, leaving me with absolutely nothing to do and nowhere to go on a Saturday night. Charles and Marion had taken pity on me. I poured cream into the coffee and was stirring it when a small voice said, "Hello, miss." It was Gary Finnegan, the boy whose mother kissed him by the classroom door in front of everyone, causing the other kids to make fun of him. He was a gentle child, with a lovely disposition. Teachers weren't supposed to have favourites, but I couldn't help liking Gary more than most of the other boys. "Hello, Gary." He stared at me, green eyes like saucers, as if he hadn't believed his teacher existed outside the four walls of the school.
"Where are your mum and dad?" I asked. "Dad's over there. He's just coming."
A harassed-looking man approached, struggling with several carrier bags. He was in his early 30s, tall and well-built, with straight fair hair and a tough, good-natured face. He wore a lightweight grey suit, and his skin bore the remains of a tan. I wondered why his brown eyes looked so sad. "Come away, Gary. Don't bother people." He smiled tiredly. "I'm sorry. Sometimes he can be over-friendly."
"But Dad," Gary piped, "it's Miss from school."
"We do know each other," I explained. "Oh, well, if that's the case." One of the bags fell and he stooped to pick it up. "I've been getting Gary some stuff for school, shorts and things." I wrinkled my nose.
"Shorts?
Is there something wrong with shorts?" He looked worried.
"Not if they're just for games," I nodded at an empty chair. "Sit down a minute, Mr. Finnegan. I'm Pearl Curran, by the way. I teach the first-year pupils, and Gary's in my class." "Rob Finnegan, how do you do?"
As we shook hands, he dropped the rest of the bags. I helped stack them beneath the table and pulled a chair up for Gary, while Rob Finnegan sat down. A waitress came immediately. He looked at me.
"Do you mind if I order? Are you expecting someone?"
"Order away. I'm not expecting anyone."
"Coffee, please, white, and a strawberry milkshake. What would you like to eat, son?"
"Sausage and chips, please, Dad."
"What a nice, polite little boy," the waitress remarked. "I won't be long, love." "So, what's wrong with shorts? Do I call you Pearl or Miss Curran?"
He ran his finger around the collar of his shirt and loosened the knot in his tie. He looked slightly less harassed.
"Call me Pearl. Shorts are a bit old-fashioned, apart from when they're worn for games."
"Old-fashioned, but I wore shorts until I was 11 and went to big school."
"That was then, and this is now. Most little boys wear long trousers, usually jeans. Gary will stand out like a sore thumb in shorts."
I didn't like to suggest he ask his wife to leave their son outside the school gates in future.
"What about a short-sleeved shirt and a tie for summer?"
I shook my head.
"The school doesn't have a formal uniform policy. Miss Burns, the headmistress, prefers the pupils to wear casual clothes. The boys in jeans, the girls in plain skirts, with red T-shirts or sweatshirts on top."
Miss Burns didn't want to put the cost of clothes out of the reach of some families who might have to resort to jumble sales to dress their children.
"You should have had a letter telling you that before Gary started school."
"I probably lost it. It was all a bit hectic in February, wasn't it, Gary?"
"Really hectic," Gary agreed. "We came back from Uganda, didn't we, Dad?"
"Uganda?" I was surprised. "I was a policeman there," he informed me. "But there was a coup, and a chap called Idi Amin came to power. We were advised to get out straight away. The guy's dangerous."
"Where are you living now?"
"In Seaforth with my sister, until we find a house of our own. She has a flat in Sandy Road." He pulled a face. "It's a bit cramped. But in the few years we've been away, house prices have shot up, and I'm having a job finding something I can afford. And I don't have much time to look, as I work nights for the post office. Once we're settled, I might rejoin the British police, though I'm wondering if it wouldn't be more sensible to go back abroad. Australia, maybe, or Canada. There are more opportunities there."
"If I went to Australia, Dad, could I have a koala bear?"
"They're a protected species, Gary," I pointed out. "You can't have them as pets." The little boy looked disappointed.
"We had Jimmy in Uganda, but he would have had to stay in kennels in England for 6 whole months, so we left him behind."
"Is Jimmy a dog?"
"No, he's a cat."
Gary frowned earnestly. "He has stripes,
and I pretended he was a tiger.
Jimmy's very old, Rob put in. We inherited him about a year ago from a family who were about to return to England. I doubt if he could have stuck it for 6 months in kennels. They're kept in cages, you know.
Did he go to live with someone as nice as you? I asked Gary.
He nodded seriously.
Even nicer, a girl called Petron... what was she called, Dad?
Petronella.
She had long gold hair right down to her feet.
I think you're exaggerating a bit there, son. Petronella's hair only reached as far as her waist.
Rob's smile completely transformed his face. He was beginning to relax.
I wondered where his wife was. It was unusual for a father to go shopping for his child's clothes. I said,
"You can take those clothes back and change them for the right ones, you know.
Won't anyone mind?
Not if you've still got the receipts."
"I've got them somewhere." He fished in his pockets and produced a pile of crumpled paper. The waitress arrived with their order. Rob asked if I'd like another cup of coffee, and I said yes. I glanced around the crowded restaurant. If people were looking, they would assume we were just an ordinary family who'd come into town to do our shopping. I didn't know why this idea gave me a certain amount of pleasure. No one would know I wasn't the wife of the man and the mother of the child. I noticed a flat W.H. Smith bag beneath the table.
"What records have you bought?"
"Jimi Hendrix, the Tremolos, Pink Floyd's Piper at the Gates of Dawn." He picked up the bag and showed me the sleeves.
"I love them all," I said delightedly. "I've got the latest Simon and Garfunkel record, Bridge Over Troubled Water. I play it all the time."
"I got a bit behind with my record collection in Uganda." He put the bag in a safer place. "Tell you what, though, I was at Litherland Town Hall one night in 1961, and I saw these four dead scruffy lads play the sort of music I'd never heard before. They only turned out to be the Beatles."
"I was there too," I cried. "I was only 15.
"I was only 18.
"Where were you sitting?"
"Right to the front. I was the mate of a mate who knew Ringo Starr."
"Me and my friend were right at the back," I laughed. "We weren't mates with anyone."
"Well, if that's not a coincidence, I don't know what is," he marvelled. "Both in the same place 10 whole years ago."
All of a sudden, he looked years younger. He was only 28, not in his 30s, as I'd thought.
"Dad plays music all the time," Gary remarked solemnly. "Bess moans because he's always using her gramophone. She likes..." He frowned. "What sort of music does Auntie Bess like, Dad?"
"Country and Western, son," his dad supplied. He turned to me and said in an appalled voice, "Her favourite singer is Connie Francis."
"Oh dear," I said sympathetically. "How can anyone prefer country and Western to rock and roll?"
"Wonders will never cease," Rob said, nodding.
"What sort of music does your mum like, Gary?" I asked. "My mum's dead, miss," he said simply. "She drowned in Spain."
I clapped my hands to my burning cheeks. I badly wanted the floor to open and swallow me.
"I'm so sorry. I never dreamt. I mean, I thought the lady who brought Gary to school was his mother."
"No, that's Bess, my sister. Oh, look, here's your coffee."
He took the coffee off the waitress's tray and put it in front of me. I drank a mouthful and it scalded my tongue. "Don't be embarrassed," he said. "How can you possibly have known? It happened 3 years ago. Gary and I talk about his mum quite openly."
"She had green eyes," Gary said, "just like me."
"Did she?" I said in a stricken voice.
"And brown hair. It was curly like mine, only mine's not brown. Mine's the same colour as Dad's."
"She sounds as if she was very pretty."
"She was dead beautiful. We've got photos of her at home, haven't we, Dad?"
"Yes, Gary." He ruffled his son's blonde curls.
They gave each other a look that seemed to say, "We're in this together." They shared a bond that didn't always exist between father and son.
"I must go."
I swallowed the rest of the coffee. It was still too hot and burnt my tongue again. I'd been about to offer to go back with them to the shops and change the clothes for the right ones. I really liked Rob Finnegan. Had allowed myself to like him. I had been pleased to discover we shared the same taste in music and had both been to the first ever Beatles concert. But it was because I had thought he was married and therefore unavailable. I kept strictly out of the way of single, available, attractive men because I was scared I might fall in love with one and end up getting married. A very dangerous thing to do. Wasn't it? I didn't know. I didn't know anything.
Kathy Burns rang, Charles said when I arrived home. I invited her to dinner with us tonight. I hope you don't mind. Will you feel awkward eating with the headmistress of the school where you work?
Not a bit, I assured him.
Marion's not very pleased. She thinks she'll want to talk about your mother all the time, and that she'll call me Charlie, he grinned. These days there's hardly anyone left to call me Charlie.
I agreed that Miss Burns would almost certainly want to talk about my mother.
She's desperate to know where she is.
Who isn't? Charles said dryly.
Still, I expect she'll turn up when she wants to. I'm off to have a bath. I've just cut the grass for the first time this year, and I'm knackered. Marion's having her hair done. She'll be back in half an hour or so.
Marion had her hair set every Saturday afternoon without fail.
Charles went upstairs and I wandered into the garden to examine the lawn. It looked intensely green and had the lovely smell that was special to freshly cut grass. I sniffed appreciatively. It cheered me that soon everything would be in full bloom, and there would be a bouquet of wonderful scents. It was mainly Charles who had created the garden. The thick privet hedge and the swollen bushes had all grown from cuttings, and the flowers from seed. It was his pride and joy. The house had been bought in 1939, when it was rare for anyone who was working class to own a property. It was a red brick semi, with three good bedrooms, two reception rooms, a breakfast room, and a garage that had been added on over the years. Charles said it had been amazingly cheap. It cost less than four figures, he often boasted, and now it was worth £5,000 or £6,000. He and Marion often looked at the houses for sale in the Liverpool Echo to check the prices, though they had no intention of moving. They even went to look at properties. It seemed to be a sort of hobby. The furniture had been expensive, solid wood, bought to last a lifetime. They would never buy another thing, however much styles might change. Marion came home, her hair intensely black and neatly set. She asked to see the clothes I'd bought. She always made a big show of admiring the style, feeling the material, commenting that the garment, or whatever it happened to be, appeared to be very good value. I didn't know if she was genuinely interested, or merely doing what she thought mothers were expected to do. My aunt wasn't interested in jewellery or clothes, possessing only her wedding ring and a tiny pair of pearl earrings that Charles had given her for a wedding present. She wore them all the time. She had two smart suits and a handful of plain dresses, skirts and tops, all in dark colours. She had never worn trousers in her life and refused to let Charles have jeans. "I didn't marry a cowboy, did I?" she'd say. We were eating in the Lonely Bell, a public house in Formby, not far from the sands. Although we were early, Catherine Burns was already in the upstairs restaurant when we arrived. She wore a midnight blue velvet trouser suit with a white frilly lace blouse underneath and a touch of makeup for a change. She looked very glamorous and considerably younger. Marion half groaned.
"Oh, sugar," she whispered. "She's smoking. You know I can't stand cigarette smoke, Charles."
"It's not my fault she smokes," Charles whispered back.
"You shouldn't have invited her."
"I'd completely forgotten she smoked." Fortunately, Miss Burns stubbed out the cigarette when she saw us coming. She stood and kissed Marion, then Charles.
"Oh, come here, Pearl," she kissed my cheek. "You're the daughter of my very best friend in the world," she said emotionally. Her breath smelled of alcohol.
"It's not much good having a best friend who's spent 20 years in prison," Marion said as she sat. Her habit of speaking her mind could be embarrassing at times. "It's even worse when the friend's released and completely disappears off the face of the earth. I mean," she snorted, "some friend."
"Friendship, like generosity, covers a multitude of sins," Miss Burns replied. She sounded more amused than annoyed. Marion opened her mouth to say something else, but changed her mind, clamping her jaw shut. I reckoned that Charles had kicked her underneath the table.
"When did we last see each other?" Miss Burns wondered aloud.
"When Amy was sent back to Holloway," Charles said. "You and I turned up to see her at the same time. I think it was about 3 years ago."
"You're right. And the last time I saw you, Marion, was at Pearl's 21st birthday party. We really should see each other more often.
Hear, hear, Charles said. He gritted his teeth. Marion had kicked him, I could tell. I hoped the evening wouldn't be spent with Miss Burns and Marion blowing poisoned darts at each other, and Marion and Charles secretly kicking each other to death. But Charles ordered a bottle of red wine and one of white, and regularly refilled their glasses without asking. By the time the meal was finished, all was sweetness and light.
Chapter 4. September 1939. Amy. Ever since they'd started work, Amy and Kathy had spent virtually all their pocket money at the pictures, sitting right at the front where the seats only cost a penny. They knew that not all girls led the same sort of lives as they did, had the same sort of jobs, or lived in a place like Bootle. American films, for instance, showed young women starring in shows on Broadway, and if they weren't on the stage, they were film stars, newspaper reporters, models, or married to desperately rich men and living in desperately posh houses. In her heart, Amy had known that her own future wouldn't offer the same choices. The best she could hope for was a husband that she loved and a slightly better house than the one in which she had been born and raised. There would, of course, be children. Amy fancied having four, and Kathy said she'd like just two. Both girls were quite content with this vision of the future that awaited them. But since the day Amy had met Barney Patterson on Southport Pier, the life she'd always known had turned into one that was beyond the wildest of her dreams. She hadn't known it was possible to be as truly and wholeheartedly happy as she was with Barney, sleeping with him, being with him almost every minute of every day. She'd given up her job in the canteen, and Barney was waiting for the war to start before he joined the forces. The Army, the Navy, or the Air Force, he didn't mind which. At 21 he was bound to be called up soon, and there might be no need for him to volunteer. Amy kept expecting a letter to drop on the mat at any moment. But until then, their time was their own, and they could do with it whatever they pleased. She prayed morning, noon, and night that something miraculous would happen to prevent the war from starting. But Barney said it was too late for that. "Things have gone too far," he assured her. Gas masks had arrived. There was a stirrup pump in the hallway. The cellar would be used as an air raid shelter. Blackout material had to be bought to make curtains, and tape stuck to the windows to prevent the glass from shattering in the event of a bomb dropping nearby. A bomb! Had she allowed herself to dwell on such horrors, Amy was convinced she would have gone out of her mind. As it was, she managed to ignore everything that was happening outside the little flat in which she and Barney lived. The flat was on the top floor of a four-story house overlooking Newsham Park. It had a big living room with a window at each end, a moderately sized bedroom, and a tiny kitchen and bathroom. It was lovely not having to go down to the yard to use the lavatory, and to have a stove with four gas rings and an oven, rather than a kitchen range that took forever to clean and polish with black lead. Mornings, the sun shone directly into the bedroom, waking them with its brightness and its warmth. Evenings, it set right outside the living room window, so that they could watch the sky change colour as it slowly disappeared behind the nearby houses. The ceiling sloped so acutely in places that sometimes Barney banged his head. The latest bruise would be fading when he'd bang it again. A silver-framed photograph of their wedding stood on the mantelpiece, just the two of them, smiling at each other. It had been the happiest day of Amy's life, and she wished Mam hadn't been so upset about it. Mam hadn't spoiled things. Nothing could have spoiled a day like that. But Amy had expected everyone to be as happy about the wedding as she and Barney. She seemed to have lost the knack of seeing things through anyone's eyes but her own. A couple in their 30s, Clive and Veronica Stafford, lived on the floor below, and Mr. and Mrs. Porter, who were very elderly, on the floor below that. Captain Kirby Green, a bachelor who'd spent most of his life in the Royal Navy, lived in the bottom flat. They were all terribly posh. Clive and Veronica had invited Barney and Amy to dinner.
"But we'll have to invite them back, and I can't cook for toffee," Amy wailed. "All I can make is scouse."
"It doesn't matter, darling," Barney said soothingly. "I bet your scouse is nicer than anything Veronica could make." They were lying on the settee. He nuzzled her neck. "If you like,
We can just say our kitchen is too small to cook in and that we'll take them out to dinner. For Barney, money was no object. When they'd first moved into the flat, he decided it was underfurnished, so had gone out and bought a brown leather settee from George Henry Lee's. It had been delivered the following morning, along with a heap of bedding, loads of other linen, a circular red rug, and a radiogram. The next day, an engineer arrived to install a telephone. Amy now had enough frocks to wear a different one each day of the week. Barney's grandparents on his father's side were dead and had left him and Harry a tidy sum of money each. Amy would have loved him just as much had he been penniless. Yet she couldn't deny that his wealth only added to the magic of her fairy tale existence. When he went into the forces, the bank would pay the rent on the flat until he came home, as well as an allowance for his wife. She refused to talk about it when he brought up the subject.
"I don't want you to go away. I don't think I'll be able to stand it. I shall probably die," she announced in a trembling voice.
She'd sooner be dead than parted from Barney.
"Oh, Amy."
He would gather her in his arms, take her into the bedroom, and they would make love, no matter what time of day it was, even if they'd only just got up. Making love was unbelievable. Amy didn't know enough words to describe it. Any road. Who would she describe it to? Only Barney. And he already knew. When it was over, they would lie on the bed, wrapped so tightly in each other's arms that they could scarcely breathe. Barney would say how fortunate it was that he'd gone to Southport on Easter Sunday. "Just think," he'd say, "if I hadn't, we wouldn't have found each other." They would be silent for a long time, trying to imagine what life would have been like had they never met. But it was impossible. An angel had been watching over them that Sunday, or perhaps even God himself. Both were convinced that their marriage had been made in heaven, and that other couples didn't love each other half as much as they did. That summer the weather was glorious, or maybe it only seemed so to Amy and Barney, who were living in their own special little world. When they weren't making love, they spent the days driving into the countryside and calling in at pubs for a drink. Some days Barney took the car through the Mersey Tunnel to places like New Brighton or Chester, or even as far as North Wales. They went to the pictures and the theatre and ate most of their meals out, although Amy loved experimenting in the kitchen. She could already make a reasonable omelette, and Barney adored her scouse, especially when it was covered with lashings of brown sauce. "That's the way me dad used to like it," she told him. "Mam would get dead cross with him. She said he ended up with more sauce than scouse." "What did your dad do?" he asked. "He drove a delivery van for Henderson's department store. Him and his mate were carrying a three-piece suite into someone's house when he had a heart attack. That was 10 years ago. I still miss him. We all do. His name was Joseph, but everyone called him Joe." She shed a few tears. She cried a lot nowadays, and not just when she was sad, which hardly ever happened, but when she felt as if she were the happiest woman on earth, like now. Some days all she and Barney did was shop. He would insist on buying Amy's mam a present, such as gloves or jewellery or bottles of scent. Chanel No. 5 or Guerlain's Shalimar. Until then, Amy and her mother had used Evening in Paris or June, dead cheap in comparison. "Mrs. Curran was really sweet," Barney said, "and as different from his own mother as chalk from cheese."
"Oh, you shouldn't, love,"
Mam cried the next time they went to see her, as she opened the box and found a silk scarf folded neatly inside. It was shell pink, with a pattern of big white flowers. Barney had chosen it. He'd bought jars of potpourri for Jackie and Biddy, who were mad about him, and chocolates for Charlie and Marion, although Marion didn't look the least bit pleased. Amy said not to take any notice. "She's a real sourpuss. No one can understand what our Charlie sees in her." Mam draped the scarf around her neck.
"It's dead pretty," she said, blushing. "I'll just go and change me shoes and put a bit of lippy on."
They were taking her for a ride in the car.
"There's no need to rush, ma-in-law," Barney said with a smile.
Mam loved being called that. Amy's heart always skipped a beat when Barney smiled, because it made him look even more handsome than he already was. She still hadn't met Barney's mother.
"When am I going to meet her?"
Amy had asked once. I mean, does she know we're married? It disturbed her that she hadn't been introduced to his parents. She knows we're married, but you're never going to meet her, Barney said flatly. Never, never, never. She hates you.
Hates me? But why?
Amy had wanted to cry. Because you're a Catholic. She loathes Catholics. I've told you that before.
She might get to like me if we met.
I'd sooner not take a chance on that, darling.
How about your father?
Pa's okay. I'll just have to find a way of getting you two together. He doesn't like to go behind Ma's back, you see. One morning towards the end of August, Barney decided it was time he and Amy had a honeymoon. Otherwise we might never have one. What with the war about to start and me likely to be called up any minute, he said. Where shall we go? It's too late to go abroad. How about a few days in London? We'll go in the car. Amy, who had been thinking of Blackpool or Morecambe, considered London a marvellous idea.
But don't forget, it's our Charlie and Marion's wedding on Saturday.
We'll buy them a wedding present while we're there, and come back Friday afternoon. Today's Tuesday, so we'll still have 2 whole days to ourselves. Seeing as how there was absolutely nothing to stop them and no need to tell anyone, Amy carefully chose 2 outfits to take with her, an emerald green frock with cap sleeves and a Peter Pan collar, and a coarse cream linen costume with a brown blouse, put on her new black pleated skirt and white tailored blouse to travel in, helped Barney pack the suitcase, and they set off. The weather was cool for August, and the sky full of clouds. Not black, heavy ones that promised rain, but the fluffy cotton-wool sort that looked as if they'd break up any minute and reveal the sun. It was pleasant driving through the little winding country roads in Cheshire and past the tall smoking chimneys of Stoke-on-Trent. Once they'd passed Birmingham, they stopped at a pub for something to eat. Amy loved the strangeness of it all, the different accents, the different smells. The fact that they were only about 100 miles away from Liverpool, yet it felt as if they were on the other side of the world. From then on the scenery became countrified again, until they reached the outskirts of London, and eventually they drove down a pretty tree-lined road that Barney said was called Park Lane. "That's Hyde Park on our left," he said. "If I turn right down there, there's a little hotel where Pa always stays. Harry and I came with him once. It's small and very comfortable. Not like these places." They were passing a palace of a building that was called the Dorchester. Their hotel was called Priest's. It was quite ordinary and inconspicuous outside. But the inside was quietly luxurious, with cream satin walls and beige carpets that were as thick as overgrown grass. As soon as they were shown to their room, Amy threw herself on the bed. She bounced up and down a few times.
"It's lovely and soft," she said.
Barney flung himself down beside her. "So it is." He slid his arms around her. "Shall we make love now, or would you like to sleep first and we'll do it later?"
"Later," Amy yawned. "I'm awful tired."
They kicked off their shoes and fell asleep in each other's arms. An hour later they woke up at exactly the same time, and Barney began to undo the buttons of her white blouse, while Amy did the same to the buttons of his shirt. Their lovemaking had been wonderful right from the start, but it seemed even more wonderful doing it in a hotel room in London, on a strange bed, in a strange city. It felt daring, exciting, and slightly sinful. Afterwards, Amy picked up the clothes that had been thrown so carelessly onto the floor, unpacked the suitcase and put everything away in the wardrobe and the lavender-scented drawers, except for Barney's hairbrushes and the toiletries, which she left on top of the tallboy. She went into the bathroom. She'd been deeply impressed to find they had a bathroom to themselves, washed her face in the big white sink, and dried it on a fluffy white towel. Both actions inexplicably making her want to explode with happiness.
"Where are we going tonight?"
she asked Barney when she came out.
"To the Theatre Royal to see Ivan Novello in The Dancing Years," Barney replied. "I asked the chap on reception to book us seats. He said there were plenty. It's the same in all the theatres. People are leaving London in their droves for somewhere safer."
"Is London dangerous?"
"Why on earth had they come if it wasn't safe?"
"It will be when the war starts," Barney said ominously. "It's one of the first places that'll be bombed. Liverpool's another."
"Shh!"
Amy stamped her foot and burst into tears.
It still might not start. Why are people so sure it will?
Barney came over and took her in his arms.
Because everyone, except you, my darling girl, just knows that there's no going back. It's like a train going down a hill at full speed and the brakes don't work.
A miracle might happen,
Amy sobbed.
I suppose it might, he agreed. But she knew he was only saying it to make her feel better.
Let's try and forget about it for the next few days, he said gently. After all, this is our honeymoon. The theatre was more than half empty. Before the curtain went up and the lights went out, Ivor Novello, the incredibly handsome star of the show, came onto the stage and asked the people at the back and in the gallery to come and sit at the front. Everybody clapped. Amy and Barney moved along their row to fill up the empty spaces and allow more people to sit in their row.
I suppose this is how it's going to be from now on, said a middle-aged woman wearing a pink satin evening dress sprinkled with sequins when Amy sat next to her. She wondered if she should buy an evening dress for herself.
What do you mean? She asked.
Things won't be normal any more. Ordinarily, we at the front would be outraged if those from the